board met in closed session on item 1A, county negotiators. Update was given on item 2A, Buena Vista Rancheria. Direction given, and the item 3A, the confidential minutes, were approved. So please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay, public matters not on the agenda. These are discussion items only. No action will be taken. Any person may address the board at this time on any subject within the jurisdiction of the Amador County Board of Supervisors. However, any matter that requires action may be referred to staff and or committee for a report and recommendation for possible action at a subsequent board meeting. Please note there is a 3-minute time limit. Is there any public comment? Well, it was on different items, though, Bill.
Oh, I see. Okay. I want to talk about the Mule Creek situation. Looks to me, trying to observe what's going on, hearing comments, reading the dispatch, is that since the county and the warden and those folk exchanged pleasantries a year ago, nothing has happened. I think everybody's just sitting around, you know, okay, we said this, you said that, but yet nothing is being done. Something needs to be done. The people in Ione are getting poisoned through what's being drafted, what's been sent down that creek. It seems to me that when all else fails, you should take more direct action. Richard, I suggest that you get a busload of people from my own, go to the Capitol with posters and signs that say, you need another reason to recall the governor? Here it is, folks. He's allowing the warden and Region Quality District to kill our people. That should be enough to cause some action to be taken by the governor. But just sitting back and doing nothing, at least I can't say that I see anything being done, just doesn't work. It doesn't cut it. I mean, at least you should try to get some publicity from the Sacramento Bee saying this is what's going on in Amador County. The managing editor of the Bee, Brenton, is a muckraker from way back. If you could stick him on it, he'd probably put out some pretty nice articles about what's going on and the governor not doing anything about it. Okay, well, that's my piece. Thank you very much.
Bill, all I can say to one part of what you said that nothing's being done. I don't think you see things that are being done, so I can't blame you for saying that. But there are things underground that are being done that just haven't come to fruition yet. State Water Board and Regional Water Quality Control Board are looking at doing things, but we just don't see that action yet.
Why can't you come out and say that, Richard? Why can't you put a notice in the paper saying, hey, folks, you probably are wondering about what's going on. Here's what's going on.
Well, because I don't have facts behind it. All I'm saying is what I hear from Dana Jorgensen and others that they're being pushed hard to take stronger action against Mule Creek. Hopefully, I'm saying myself, hopefully that means them putting in a plant to appropriately treat the constituents that come out of the prison.
Go to the state capitol, Richard. Bring a bullhorn. I'll shout out for trying to do what's right for the citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Is there any other public comment today? Is there anybody on Zoom that would like to? Supervisor Neto, would you like to say something?
Yeah. Just the other day, we lost a longtime member of our community. Mr. Dick Cooper. He passed away, and Dick was well known, well liked in the community, and he earned it. Dick was, I'd say, a real old school guy, very knowledgeable, just an all around good citizen, and he will be sorely missed in the community. And I give my sympathy to his family, and he was a hell of a man.
Thank you. Anybody else on the board?
Yeah, I'll concur with Supervisor Ornato there. Very good person and good family. Dick Cooper did a lot for the community, for Shenandoah Valley. And I'll make one other comment. I did get a message from Jim Geedy that Jake is not feeling well today, so he's going to try to get him in here, but I would not anticipate that happening for the live streaming.
Also, Mr. Chair, if we could, I'd like to have a moment of silence in memory of Mr. Cooper.
Absolutely. Let's take a few moments for to remember Mr. Cooper. Was there anybody on Zoom that wanted to make a comment? Okay, so moving on from public matters not on the agenda, approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion from Supervisor Ornato to approve, second from Supervisor Crew, as is. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. No opposed, so motion carries. Approval of the consent agenda.
Move to approve.
Okay. We have a motion from Supervisor Brown, second from Supervisor Forster to approve the consent agenda. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right. Regular agenda, we're going to move on to item 4A, update of the Amador County, update by the Amador County Health Officer, Dr. Riedeker, on the COVID-19 situation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It sounds like you're able to hear me.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Good morning, Amador County and supervisors. I'm glad to be able to update you on where Amador County stands in relation to COVID-19 as of today. There have been 1,878 confirmed cases of COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic in Amador County residents. That excludes Mule Creek State Prison inmates. 645 of those cases in Amador residents have been confirmed since January 1st of this year, year to date. Current active cases in Amador residents are 14. Cases are released from isolation when they're no longer contagious. To date, 158 Amador County residents are known to have been hospitalized due to COVID-19, but no current Amador County residents are hospitalized. 39 Amador County residents and 9 Mule Creek State Prison inmates have died of COVID-19, and public health expresses our deepest sympathies to everyone who has lost someone they cared about to COVID-19. During the month of June, weekly case episode counts ranged between 10 and 19 cases per week. Over the past 2 weeks, for the week of June 27th through July 3rd, we've so far confirmed 10 case episodes. And for the week of July 4th through July 10th, 6 case episodes so far. Sometimes that number will go up when people express that their symptoms began before they got tested by a few days, and so that tally is not firm yet. Contact tracing continues to show transmission within households and linkages to out-of-state travel, primarily driving our case counts. The more highly transmissible Delta variant of the virus has been identified in Amador case clusters, including in fully vaccinated people who spent time indoors with a contagious person, where less air circulation leads to higher virus levels in the environment of the air. Those people have on occasion tested positive. Generally, those who become infected after vaccination have a milder course of illness, Although people who have immune compromise, especially older persons, may not have had a robust immune response to the vaccine. Two such individuals from Amador County have been hospitalized and one passed away. That is why, given that the Delta variant has become the dominant strain circulating in California, public health advises that those who are concerned about their immune response to the vaccine or live with someone who is unvaccinated or immune compromised, consider adding back the additional layer of protection by wearing a mask indoors when they're in public, even if they're fully vaccinated. Anyone who is not vaccinated should be wearing a mask indoors when in public. The current Amador test positivity rate is 3.2%, which is up from 1% during my last report to the board 3 weeks ago. The public health team continues our core work, including disease investigation and contact tracing of COVID cases, as we do for communicable diseases in general. Isolation of confirmed cases and quarantine of close unvaccinated contacts continues to be important to control the spread of COVID-19. COVID-19 vaccine update. At this point, over 34,300 doses have been administered to date to persons who live in Amador County. 62.6% of Amador County residents age 12 and up have had at least one dose of vaccine. Over 15,500 Amador residents are fully vaccinated, and about 5,000 more have had their first dose of a two-vaccine series. It is very important to complete that second dose of the two-dose series vaccine to have the most possible protection against variant strains. For example, studies in the United Kingdom showed 33% protection against the Delta variant after the first dose of Pfizer vaccine. That increases to 88% protection 2 weeks after the second dose. Fully vaccinated people do not need to quarantine nor get tested, even if they're a close contact to a case of COVID-19, as long as they remain without symptoms. Fully vaccinated people could test positive after especially prolonged indoor contact to a COVID-19 case, but those without symptoms are very unlikely to shed high enough levels of the virus to effectively transmit to others. Their vaccine-induced immunity doesn't allow the virus to make enough copies of itself for them to pose a significant risk of being contagious. As far as vaccine clinics sponsored by public health upcoming, we are continuing to hold pop-up outreach walk-in clinics, now offering both the Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer vaccines. For J&J, you must be 18 or older. For Pfizer, 12 or older. And minors must have a parental or legal guardian consent sign. There's a clinic happening this morning at the Fiddletown Community Center from 9 a.m. to noon. And then on Saturday, June 17th, our team will be at the Sutter Creek Farmers Market from 9 a.m. till noon. You may check the amadorgov.org website, click on the red COVID-19 banner at the top, and in the left side, the vaccine information tab to find a calendar showing when and where pop-up vaccine clinics are taking place. And homebound individuals may call to schedule an appointment for a nurse home visit to get vaccinated by calling 209-223-6407. Other clinics in Amador County continuing to vaccinate their patients include Sutter Health, WellSpace Health, and the Max Clinic. And people who get care at Kaiser, the VA, or other health systems outside the county may also be able to access vaccines through their own provider. Four pharmacies in Amador County continue to offer vaccination, CVS, Safeway, Walgreens, and Walmart. And by visiting vaccines.gov, you can search for the availability by type of vaccine at the various pharmacies. The no-cost OptumServe testing site remains open at the back entrance of the Health and Human Services Building, Suite 500, off Lower Ridge Road, still available Monday, Wednesdays, and Saturdays from 7 a.m. till 3 p.m. No appointment necessary, just drive up, park at the cones, and the staff will assist you with both on-site registration and specimen collection from your car, if it's cool enough. Once in a while, they're working from inside the building now on these super hot days. Adults and children can be tested with results within 2 days. And if you would like to schedule ahead, you may visit lhi.care/COVID testing or call 1-888-634-1123. Immunity through vaccination slows the spread and lessens the emergence of variant strains of the virus. Fully vaccinated people have good protection against the recently emerging strains, including the Alpha and Delta strains. When the virus cannot find a susceptible host to multiply in, it is less likely that more significant variant mutations will emerge. Get vaccinated if you haven't already to protect yourself, your family, your loved ones, and our community. Avoid crowds and poorly ventilated spaces. Outdoor activities are safer than indoors, and in fact, at this point, no one needs to wear a mask outdoors. Wash or sanitize your hands frequently. Now that most community-wide measures that minimize virus transmission have been lifted, it's particularly important that anyone who feels ill, even with mild symptoms, stay home, especially if you're waiting COVID-19 test results. If you don't feel great, please isolate. And I'd be happy to address any questions at this time.
Supervisor Crew?
Yeah, hello, Dr. Kerr. How you doing this morning? Supervisor Crew, just for our homebound clients, is that a free service for the entire? There's not an extra charge for that?
No extra charge for that. No.
Or for the pop-up clinics, it's the same as if they drove to HHS?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. At this point, there should be no charge to any individual to receive a vaccine anywhere. There are pharmacies or clinics that will collect insurance information just to bill for the administration fee to the insurance, but no cost to the individual.
Thank you.
Supervisor Forrester.
Morning, Dr. Kerr.
Morning.
Three questions for you. One is a follow-up from the last meeting where an individual tested, had a contact with her spouse that he ended up having COVID. She tested negative, and then she tested positive, and then she tested negative. Mm-hmm. So my question is, are those positive tests removed from your count once that you figure out that there is a false positive?
Oh, that is a good question. And in the case you're referencing, the two subsequent tests, the last two tests, were actually both detectable, but not in a range that could have been contagious. And that's why the close contacts with that individual were told once we got the second test result that they would not need to continue quarantine. There is an entire algorithm that we use regarding symptomatic state needing to remain asymptomatic, number one. And then when available, virus levels to determine if a test was truly a false positive. And when we do determine that a test is a false positive, we do remove it from the count.
If you detect levels of COVID, albeit small, is that still considered a false positive?
The ideal is that we get a if we have a positive with borderline levels, or that is an unexpected positive, this, for example, would be somebody who works in healthcare, who's fully vaccinated, no known risk exposure, tested with a screening test and test positive, either with an antigen test or the molecular test. And then we say, we did not expect this person to be positive, so we actually do two follow-up tests within 48 hours. And then if those two follow-up tests are both negative, we can call that a false positive and remove it from the count.
But you start the contact tracing immediately.
We do, because we want to make sure that if they were infectious, until we have that second and third result, that anybody they've been in contact with would be quarantining during that time, and we'd have that person isolate till we rule it out and determine the false positive state.
Okay, thank you. Two more questions.
False positives are more common with the antigen test than with the molecular test.
Okay, two more questions. You mentioned on the Delta variant that second dose of Moderna and Pfizer decreases the chance of getting Delta variant, but I haven't heard anything on the Johnson & Johnson shot, which is one dose.
The Johnson & Johnson shot has shown effectiveness against both the Alpha and the Delta variants as well. Some protection after 2 weeks, even more protection after 4 weeks. The antibodies levels continue to build over time. The protection has not been quite as high as the two-dose regimens, but is still considered effective, especially at protecting against serious illness, hospitalization, or death.
Okay, thank you. Last question. Back to the high school cheer squads. Are mm-hmm. they allowed to do their cheer routines and things like that now?
As far as we know, yes, particularly if they're outdoors. At this point, there's really very few restrictions on outdoor activities, including sports and cheer. Where we are, you know, going to have to be concerned going forward is when athletics are happening indoors because people are physically exerting themselves. They're more likely to have, you know, if there's a contagious person in the room physically exerting themselves with a lot more air exchanges, the level of virus could rise in that room. So indoors, continuing distancing, potential testing, and possibly mask wearing when it's a non-contact practice kind of situation is what I would expect to see going forward. That was what was foreshadowed in some of the guidance that came out late last week.
I got to tell you, I really disagree with the interpretation that they're spectators and not athletes.
I agree.
To me, it's a very sexist interpretation since most of the cheerleaders are female. And it just, if you watch what they do, they are athletes.
I understand that, and that is why we advocated and lobbied to get that changed from the get-go and eventually succeeded.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Supervisor Netto, you had some questions?
Yeah. Can the COVID vaccine cause positive tests?
No, it cannot.
Okay.
It's detecting a different part of the virus, and it's detecting a different, you know, marker of the genetic part of the virus.
Also,
so it cannot cause a positive.
Okay. If you test a person, and they come up positive and made numerous tests positive, or is each test viewed as a, for the statistics, as a positive in the county, or is it viewed as one positive?
Good question. It is considered one case episode and only tallied once. The one exception to that is if someone tested positive last year sometime and then gets reinfected with a variant out of the time window where we expect, and at this point it's a 90-day time window. Some have advocated to move it out to 120 days. After a prior test where there could be still small fragments occasionally showing up on a test. But if someone's truly reinfected, symptomatic again, and testing positive again with significant levels of virus, that would be considered a reinfection, and that case would be tallied a second time.
And one more question. President Biden has stated that they're looking to have, it sounds like, volunteers go around and knock on doors and inquire as to a person's vaccination status. Have you had any contact with the federal government or the state with any type of request or to work with you to do that?
Not at this point. We are continuing to try and take vaccine to where people are in the community, partnering with ongoing community events like the community center today and the farmers market on Saturday. But so far in our jurisdiction, we have not considered a door-to-door approach. I know that there are neighborhoods in California where people have significant transportation challenges where that type of approach has been used, but not on, and it's always been on a voluntary basis. No one's obliged to answer the door.
If you have any contact from them wanting to do such, I would appreciate knowing so.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any other board questions, comments? Okay. Any public comment? Please come to the podium.
Morning, Dr. Kerr. Bill May.
Morning, Mr. May.
I get up early as old people sometimes usually do, and I get on the computer, and I was looking at blogs. Seven in a row had different instructions as to whether or not school kids had to wear a mask.
Very
hot. How do you, what are you, What's your recommendation? Should they wear the mask? Or?
Unvaccinated school kids should absolutely be wearing masks to, first of all, allow for enough kids to be in a classroom so that the goal is to get everyone back to full-time in-person instruction this year. None of this 2 days on, 2 days at home thing. We want to be able to get all our kids in the classroom. In order to do that, we have to put them closer together. Last year, they started with 6 feet apart. Then they moved down to 3 feet apart. And the CDC guidance that was published on Friday says, well, if you can maintain 3 feet apart, maybe the fully vaccinated kids don't need to wear masks. But the recommendation is absolutely if they need to be closer than 3 feet apart, which I'll be, you know, meeting with our local school administrators to work out all their plans now that some guidance has been published, the masks will absolutely affect the keeping the chain of transmission minimal in the classroom.
As I read through the blogs, the first instruction was it was a mandate, mask had to be worn in schools. That was almost immediately followed by, no, 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 maybe not. District by district, you can make those kind of determinations. I think school districts have a really hard time trying to figure out which way to go.
Right. I agree. And the headlines can be misleading. At this point, what has been published is that it would be a mandate. I think the question is about enforcement of the mandate at the local level, but there has not been clarity yet provided on that topic.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Bill. Any other public comment? Come on up, Jack.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Kurtz. Jack Gorman with Amador Vintners.
Good morning, Jack.
I have received a few inquiries, and I think we know the answer, but I'd like to get it clarified, is that as both the Vintners Association and our members are starting to ramp up larger events, and are there any protocols or anything different that we or members need to be doing, and are there any numbers? I haven't seen anything, but I just wanted to, and we're never going to be over that 5,000 number, so.
That's what I was going to ask. If you're going to be a mega event of 5,000 indoor would be the highest risk. And in those cases, there are some guidelines for masking indoors, obviously, which is still recommended for all unvaccinated people, or vaccine status informing whether or not people need to be vaccinated if you're indoors. I know a lot of your events are primarily outdoors in the fall with maybe just a foray into a tasting room. So, you know, with people moving around and mixing, that's, you know, it's a lot of different venues. I don't think you're meeting that threshold of the 10,000 for outdoors.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Any other public comment? Anybody on? Oh, Supervisor Crew.
Dr. Kerr, again, I forgot to ask one. I know that these pop-up clinics were to stimulate the number of people getting vaccinated. Is it too early to tell if that's been a success? I know you've only had a couple of them so far, right?
You know, I think we have reached some people who may not have come otherwise. They say, you know, it's just too far to drive from. We had one up at the Pioneer IGA, for example, and we had a number of people who visited that one who didn't want to make their way all the way down the hill. So I think they have been effective that way. They're definitely lower volume than our massive vaccination clinics that we were having a few months ago when demand was high. But at this point, our goal is to really get out there and reach people who might not be reached otherwise. And it's working.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other public comment? Anybody on Zoom? Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to thank you for your informative update, Dr. Kerr, and appreciate what you and everybody over at Public Health is doing. And we'll see you next time.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, moving on to item 4B, and this is the introduction of our new CHP commander for the Amador area, Lieutenant Todd Thibodeau, and I believe he's in the audience. Hopefully I didn't hurt your name or mispronounce your name, but please come on up, Todd.
And give us a correct pronunciation.
Yes. Tip your hat, tip your toe, and that's how you say tip-a-doe. something like that?
Good morning. Good morning to the board. Yeah, absolutely correct on the name pronunciation, so congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
It's usually mispronounced many times. But I'm, again, new to the Amador area. I come from a about a 24-year law enforcement career all over the state, and very excited about working in the county and with the residents and the community to you know, maintain public safety.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Great.
Is this Supervisor Forster, is Amador County, is are we still, or CHP in general, are you still having trouble getting your ranks, your numbers up through the academies?
Yes, as a whole, our academy is ramping back up after the pandemic, and we're working on getting more classes in. We're going to graduate a class here in the next couple weeks, I believe. But yeah, with the academy being closed down, it has had an impact on not recruitment, but getting more officers on the field.
But that won't affect our numbers, our stable numbers in Amador County of officers?
It should not affect it. We are down a couple positions currently, and with a couple out on injury, and we're working always to maintain those numbers and the staffing that we have. But public service should not be affected by the lower staffing numbers. We do have alternative measures to handle that.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to go up to Lake Tahoe and Reno in the last month, and fortunately, the older I get, the slower I drive, so I wave at the people when CHP has them pulled over. So.
Yeah, this is Supervisor Onetto, and glad you're coming here, but I will say people are driving like they're nuts anymore.
Yes, that's been the same thing statewide. In fact, some of our statistics statewide, especially when traffic got lighter, when people were teleworking or not working, traffic volumes were a lot lighter, a lot higher speeds. You know, as far as the county numbers, I have to look at what we have countywide, but we do have officers out there, you know, patrolling all of our main routes and Highway 49, and that's my commuting every day. I'd like to say I'm in an unmarked car, and I have not seen a lot of crazy drivers because I don't have the black and white car that normally gets the attention to make people slow down. So, but again, you know, we can't be everywhere, but of course, you know, we are going to do our best to ensure that traffic safety is a priority and that people are, you know, following the speed limit and following the rules.
Yeah, it's not always even the speed, it's just how they drive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I've noticed. I mean, you see some people are going along, they might even be able to speed limit, but they're driving stable, I guess you'd call it.
Mm-hmm.
And you see some doing over the speed limit, under the speed limit, and they're bouncing off the walls.
Yeah. My commute prior to coming here was Highway 50 every day, and I can attest that traffic was fairly higher speeds and a lot more
erratic
drivers driving unsafely.
Plus, there's those people that go up to see the snow and just pull off on the side of the road thinking it's a parking space.
More so in Lake Tahoe and Truckee, but
yeah.
I hear that happens here too. I can't wait for the first winter.
Right, well, on Highway 50 in, you know, particular.
Yes.
Any other board
comments? I'd like to welcome you, Supervisor Brown. I'm out of the upcountry from Pine Grove all the way up to Kirkwood. One of my aspects is, I don't know why it is, but we've had numerous people just love to pass on the double yellow line.
Mm-hmm.
I've been passed personally in Red Corral, you know, where there's a turning lane there, and I'm like, really? There's a logging truck ahead. You know, you're going to actually beat the logging truck? And so it's, and then, you know, I have a couple neighborhoods that I've got some speeders, and I'm always trying to get a speed survey done through the county, but that's my problem to work on to give you your teeth that you need. So I do welcome you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'll give you two areas that I see as problem. Well, I have it from individuals that Latrobe Road in the morning, 7:30, 8:00. There's an individual with a big pickup there now, and he's changed to a car. He's routinely passing on double yellow lines around curves. And people are just scared to death, the friends of mine that are driving, that somebody's going to get killed there. The other one is going up to Reno the other day, up 88. You get behind people, and this happened to be mostly vehicles, not trucks, that they're going slow enough where they get up to 7-8 vehicles behind them. They should be using the turnouts, correct?
Correct.
Well, they don't. And then when they hit a passing area, they speed up to 70 miles an hour.
That is
makes
true.
It very difficult for anyone to pass them. And it's unsafe because people are going over the double yellow lines when the passing lane ends and into the other lane to get around them. But if you could ask your officers to really key on those people that are not abiding by the law and using the turnouts as they should be.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, my commute is Latrobe Road every day. I understand the dangers on that road, and it's a very narrow. I've already run into three incidents in my 3 weeks here, mm-hmm. with crashes or dogs running in the road or people off the road. And rest assured, I mean, on my commute, I will take appropriate action if that does happen. And with our widespread county, getting people out to those areas is difficult sometimes, but we do have task forces that go out. We'll focus enforcement on those areas, but I will note those for sure.
All right. Thank you, and welcome to Amador County.
Thank you.
This is Supervisor Onetto. I must concur, Supervisor Forrester. It's amazing. Yeah, they go up the mountains doing 40 miles an hour. They hit a passing lane, they're doing 70.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As soon as the passing lane ends, they slow back down. Also, if you're traveling Latrobe Road a lot, that's a bad road. But if you can take a detour and go up Old Sacramento Road into Plymouth sometimes, mm-hmm. there are some people flying down that road.
In fact, I came home that way the other day as an alternate route. Not as quick, obviously, to get to where I'm going. But, yeah, I will take that road, and we do have patrols out there occasionally.
Okay.
And same type of issues, people passing double yellows and speed.
Pretty high speed.
Okay.
And there's it's kind of a rural ag area, and so some of the places are pretty close to the road with their barns and stuff, and they're scared. But like the rest of the board said, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'll pass the word on these issues, and again, if there's any other issues that come up, our complaint officer or our traffic complaint officer at the office keeps track of all traffic complaints. In fact, I got one from Supervisor Axe the other day about some commercial traffic up the hill, and we do monitor those traffic complaints, and we do work those often. So if anyone has one, please feel free to call the office, speak to Warren Clausen, who's our traffic complaint officer, and we do note those and we do work those areas.
Does CHP have any impact on things like I've heard there's going to be a bike race up on 89 or something, the road that goes over to Lake Tahoe from 88,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to shut down the whole road this weekend. You have any information on that?
I heard a little bit about it yesterday. I believe it's called the Death Ride.
That's it?
Yes.
That is it.
So if the road is going to be shut down, the appropriate, so South Lake Tahoe or Placerville, I'm not sure which one handles that jurisdiction. Working in counties where they do have large events like that, if they do get the permits and they do pay for the services, they can get that done. It should have very little impact on traffic, but of course it has to be approved by the county. So ultimately, they're the ones that decide if that's something they want to do for that event.
Yeah, I've heard they're going to just shut down the whole road, though, so it would block. You wouldn't even be able to use that as an access to get to Lake Tahoe.
Okay. I'm not aware of that, but I can check into it for you.
Okay.
And if that's the case, obviously, if traffic is impacted and affects the Amador area going out that way, then we can put the notifications out to folks that may not be in the area and have that information.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So you're saying Highway 88 is going to be closed?
89.
It sounds like 89 is going to be closed. As you go up 88 and turn to go to Lake Tahoe, the first
over
Luther Pass.
Pass,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's just, for a bicycle race, it's a major inconvenience for a lot of people that utilize our highways.
Right. Yes, go ahead, Mr.
Commander, I'm sorry. As Supervisor Crew, your office is in my jurisdiction, so I wanted to give you an official welcome, too. So if you have any home-based problems, probably the guy to talk to.
Absolutely. That's good to know. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right.
That.
You know, I have one more item, Mr. Chair. Also, I thought you might like to know, maybe 6 months to a year ago, this board passed the resolution supporting our local law enforcement. So,
well, thank you very much.
Any other questions or comments? Any comments from the public? Zoomers? Okay. Well, Todd, thank you for coming down and introducing yourself, and we look forward to working with you.
Absolutely. Same here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hamilton County.
Welcome. Okay, so we're moving on to item 4C. This is a presentation by local Red Cross, and it's related to emergency sheltering and the current protocols that will be followed due to the pandemic. And we have a PowerPoint presentation on this, correct?
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you. First of all, thank you for having me here. My name is Debbie Calcote. I'm the Disaster Program Manager for the American Red Cross. My areas of service are Amador, Calaveras, and Tuolumne counties. I've been with Red Cross for 16 plus years. And kind of wanted to go over a little bit of what we're doing now. Last year, of course, was the onset of the pandemic. We handled sheltering in a different way. We did it a non-congregate way, which meant that we utilized hotels instead of doing folks into massive shelters. This year, we've kind of gone back to sheltering, still being fully aware of the pandemic. It's still on and still going. If you could progress the slide, there we go. So what we're doing is we actually have a temporary evacuation point. So all of our whenever we get the call for a where evacuations are going to be taking place, we'll be opening a temporary evacuation point. And what the temporary evacuation point is a location where everyone can go to, either the fairgrounds, someplace that there is a large enough place that we can have the cars there, be able to have people safe distance, so that we can get information on where they're coming from, what part of the incident, fire, whatever it is that's taking place. We can gather information from them. We can wait to gather information from our Office of Emergency Services, our law enforcement, to know exactly what's going on. Not all incidences and not all evacuations are going to require a full-time shelter. Sometimes they are able to get a handle on the situation, and it doesn't have to go into a full-on evacuation shelter. So the temporary evacuation point gives us that timeline to where we can see how the situation is going. What is it going to look like? Sometimes folks can go back to the area that's been impacted, nothing's damaged, fire is able to get something under control. Next slide, please. So usually the Office of Emergency Services, Health and Human Services, one of those will make the designation as to where they want the temporary evacuation point located. We have several that we have chosen in the area, or Health and Human Services, Public Health have chosen areas designated to use as a temporary evacuation point or as a shelter. This, of course, again, like I say, it's a safe place for people to go to. We provide snacks and water. Want to remind that this is not a location for a shelter. This is simply a place where we can gather information. The people that have been evacuated, it gives them a chance to find out further information on what's going on. It's a place that law enforcement and fire can provide us information that we can pass on to the folks who have been evacuated. It kind of gives them a place to catch their breath. It's safe. We can provide them information as it's being provided to us. Next slide, please. So again, local authorities are the ones that advise us where they would like us to open these facilities. They're the ones that know exactly what direction. I'm going to use an example as fire, since we are in fire season and we've got several going as it is. So they're the ones that are going to advise us the best place to open the temporary evacuation point and also be starting to look for a potential congregate sheltering site. They have the information based on the direction the fire may be heading in, or the wind shifts, the fire behavior, all of that. So they have the critical information that they're going to tell us. We may say, well, the Italian fairground seems like a really good place that we can open one of these. And they're going, no, because of the fire behavior, the direction of the fire, that's not a good choice. We want you to do it over here. So we rely on them to be the ones to advise us where they want that located. Activating it, we do not activate on our own. Red Cross does by no means self-activate. We cannot respond unless we are requested by the Office of Emergency Services or Health and Human Services. That is the only time Red Cross is activated in a county. Again, we have a lead position that once the temporary evacuation point has been asked by Health and Human Services and Office of Emergency Services, we have a lead that takes on the position right away. Their main role is activating and that communication between our Office of Emergency Services and gets everything going, directs the clients with actions for the clients and community partners. They're responsible for the safety and security of the temporary evacuation point. We have personnel, Red Cross volunteers, who are, they're called LSEP, which is our safety, asset, and protection folks. They go through a specific training. Some of them are retired law enforcement or fire who have some sort of background training, but we also provide our own. We also have a TEP coordinator that is on site. They're the ones that make sure we have the PPE supplies so that those are readily available for not only our workers but for our clients that come in. Anyone that comes into the temporary evacuation point will have to do PPE. They will have to do a face mask because of COVID protocol. We can't rely on everyone being vaccinated or take the risk that everybody is vaccinated. So we are taking on the care of caution that everyone isn't vaccinated for the protection. So again, the purpose of the temporary evacuation point is to provide a location where we can protect the health of our workforce and the clients by maintaining a non-contact communication. We prefer people to stay in their vehicles, air conditioning going. It's going to be difficult with the extreme heat that we have going this time. So we're trying to look for locations or utilize locations where we can use the inside of a temporary evacuation point while using the social distancing at least 60 square feet of space between families or groups inside while maintaining face masks and sanitizing areas. It would be chairs to separate folks as well. Our registration is everybody goes in, anybody that goes in, there's a screening process, no different than what it was in the beginning of COVID. The same health questions are answered each time anyone goes in or comes out. They're asked those same health questions. And this applies to the temporary evacuation point as well as our congregate sheltering sites.
Would you prefer we wait on questions, or can we ask them?
Oh, no, you can ask in between. My apologies.
You talk about that rule of social distancing. That can't apply to families, can it?
No, not to families, but we're talking about folks that they may know a neighbor and whatnot, and they want to socialize with them. And they can do that outside. By all means, they can do it outside. But inside the facility, we discourage it because we're trying to keep everybody as safe as we can. As we all know, the virus and the variant is still with us. And our job as Red Cross is to try to keep the community as safe as possible. And the only way we can do that is by the social distancing within our facilities that we're running.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Again, temporary evacuation points could be parking lots, local businesses, schools. We try to find the largest areas that we can now because of COVID. Before, it wasn't as needed, the larger facilities, because we could have people together. But now with COVID, we're looking for, of course, larger areas. Next slide. Okay, our clients are given information packets. With those, it kind of gives them an idea of what is going to take place as far as the temporary evacuation point, what it's going to be like if we have to go into a congregate sheltering situation. In their packet, they are given a hand sanitizer, tissue, face mask, and an index card. And on the index card, they're to write down their information for us as far as where they've been evacuated from, the address, and a phone number. And then we gather that information back. This is their one of the client information sheets. Everything we have is in English and Spanish. We also have interpreters that we can reach out to that are within the Red Cross for any language. And then going for our temporary evacuation point to our congregate sheltering in a COVID environment, The slide that you see over on the right, which shows the cots all lined up, that was pre-COVID. So since COVID, they will be 110 square feet per cot. So it's quite a big difference. Before it was 40 square foot per cot, we're now 110. So that limits our space in each facility for the number of people that we can house in a congregate sheltering. So it may be that we have to open more than one shelter, where before we could open one and put more people in it. Now we're looking at smaller numbers of people, more facilities to open. You can go ahead and skip, because I just kind of all went through that. So our congregate shelter strategies is screening and access control with shelter entry barriers, increased sanitation activities. This means every hour, everything being sanitized down, social distancing, isolation care areas. Those will be set up within the congregate sheltering. Our public health department will go in to make sure that they are set up properly. And that they pass the health department's code per county, because each county has their own way that they'd like it done. Our screening and sheltering flow and what that looks like. Go ahead, next slide. Screening area, everyone, including visitors and staff, prior to entering any shelter. We're controlling the shelter entrances 24/7. There will only be two, where before we would have sometimes four entrances or exits out of the sheltering locations. Now there's only two, so they can be better monitored so that we reduce the risk of any contamination. Our questions, the same COVID questions that have been answered since the very beginning. Have you been out of the area? Have you been ill? Have you been around anybody who's had COVID or showing any symptoms of COVID? Those will be asked each time. Same thing, if their answers are yes or no, based on that, they'll be sent to the isolation area if anything is yes. And in our isolation area, those are only healthcare providers are the only ones that are allowed in there. No one else is allowed in those areas. Again, our dormitory space, 110 square feet per person. If we're doing the temporary evacuation point where we need to get people out of the heat and the cars, or some people have cars that don't have air conditioning, older models, and we have to use a facility, it would be 60 square foot per person and using just chairs. Excuse me. The dormitory layout is foot to head, head to foot, so that somebody rolls over in the middle of the night, they're going to be coughing on your feet and not in your face, even though it's 110 square feet apart. We don't want that risk. Setting up the isolation care, as I was saying, it is set up before the shelter can even open its doors. Again, this is what the standard CDC isolation care area should look like, but each county's public health may have a different plan that they would like, so we would have them come in and inspect it first before we actually open those doors. Feeding is, and that's a different process as well. Next slide. This is our maintaining social distancing while feeding as well. Last year during the pandemic, at the height of it, when we were doing non-congregate, it was individual meals packaged by restaurants and fast food and delivered to our clients in their hotel rooms. Everyone was put into a hotel room. This year, with the we got the guidance that we can go back to having restaurants prepare food, but put them in the Cambros, as in bulk food. Then our safe handling volunteers who've gone through the safe handling food process can then put the food into clamshells, and then there is dividers put on the table. The food is set on the table. As you can see, it's 6 feet apart, all those, and then there is plexiglass between that. And then they can come up, get their food, and then they have to walk completely away from the area before the next, and the table is wiped down before the next family comes and gets it. So it's a little longer process, but it's the safest way that we can help protect those that are going to be fed. The feeding set up the same way. Ensure hand washing stations and hand sanitizer is always there. The space, the table, 6 feet of distance between both the clients and the workers. Our workers will always have the gowns, the hairnets, the face shields, masks, when they are preparing the food from the Cambrose into the clamshells and then putting them on the table for the clients to pick up the clamshell and go sit to eat. Individually packaged meal, there may come a time when, if it's late at night, that we have to go through a fast food restaurant to get the prepared meal, which most of our disasters we know start in the middle of the night, and so we can't always get a restaurant to get us food in bulk to do that. So we, lots of times, will order fast food to carry us through till the morning. And then 20 times a year, we're establishing shelters or doing multi-family fires or our local house fires. The whole time we're doing that, we're providing direct financial support, providing blankets, comfort kits. We didn't change. We still, through COVID, we still responded. We still respond. And we're still looking for volunteers. So if anybody would like to volunteer, more than welcome to have you join our team. And if there's any questions.
Supervisor Forrester.
One question. Back to the temporary
evacuation point.
Well, temporary, before they make the decision to open a building, the way it reads, and I don't see the page number, but the way it reads is clients will be requested to remain in vehicles until a decision is made to move to the next level, but there should not necessitate clients spend the night in their vehicles.
No.
What happens if it's 105 degrees out there? They have to stay in their vehicles?
No, that's what I was saying earlier. If, because of the temperatures the way they are, we would then make the facility where it would be 60 square foot per person. We'd have the chairs lined up within a facility for them to be inside the facility.
So you would convert it based on the
temperatures climate outside
or anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know if I'd rather be in a car in 100 degrees or sitting in a chair all day long. So.
It's a tough, yeah, it's a catch-22. But that's really not much of a difference from pre-COVID when we had temporary evacuation points. They were just called evacuation centers pre-COVID, and you would, everyone would cut, the law enforcement would say, go evacuate to the fairgrounds, and people would stand around outside in the heat waiting for the next phase of what was going to happen.
Any other? Supervisor Brown?
This is Supervisor Brown. My question is the simpler, not the evacuation, but like a cooling center that OES calls you on or a warming center. Do you handle that at all?
No. Red Cross has not done cooling centers or warming centers for probably 6 years now.
Okay.
We do support those with snacks and water, but we don't do it with staff.
Don't do it with staff. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
These, your protocols, are they worked on and designed with consultation with the state?
Yes, they are, and they're done through Washington, D.C. and state.
Okay, because I'm looking at California now, and it's opening up, and masks are becoming a thing of the past sometimes. So I guess because you're a congregation of people, that's why you're requiring the mask to be worn, or they're requiring the mask to be worn?
Right, because we still have COVID. The virus is still active and around, and we're having a group of people within a building, and not everyone is vaccinated, and so to protect those who aren't, and we don't have the right to ask anyone if they're vaccinated. So we have to go under the assumption that no one is vaccinated while in our facility. So the best way to keep everyone safe is to ask everyone to wear a mask while inside the building.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other board questions or comments? Is there any public comment that's in person or on Zoom? Okay. Well, Debbie, I would like to thank you for a very informative presentation, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. All right. Before we move on to item 4D, maybe we can take a 5-minute break?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Because I think 4D, and then we have a public hearing at 10:30.
10:30, yeah.
Yeah. So 5-minute break, and then we'll hit 4D.
Okay.